Guardian Unlimited.
I'm Alok Jha, and this is Science Weekly for September the 10th. Coming up on this week's show, we discuss the ethics thrown up by the rapid advances in our understanding of genes. What use is your personal genome? Should scientists try to create synthetic life forms? And how far should medical research be allowed to go? We'll tell you about the men in white coats that have concluded that rock stars live shorter lives than us mere mortals. And guess what? It has everything to do with sex, drugs, and rock and roll. Plus, bad news for dog lovers and the gene that makes you skinny. This is Science Weekly from Guardian Unlimited. Greetings, people of Podland. We're fired up for another show, but are you ready to receive us? Let me introduce the supporting cast. Guardian science correspondents Ian Sample and James Randerson have climbed up four flights of stairs to be here today. Ian Sample and James Randerson.
Hello, Alok.
Hello.
Nell Bowes from Guardian Unlimited's arts blog has sailed halfway around the world to make her long-awaited return to the pod. My, how we've missed you.
Oh, I've missed you lot too.
And finally, a delayed hello to Science Weekly's troubadour physicist, Johnny Berliner.
Hello.
Now, over the past week, a number of stories concerning the science and ethics of genetics have come up in the news. Craig Venter published his own DNA sequence. A High Court judge called for the entire UK population and everyone who visits us to be placed in a DNA database. Then the Human Fertilisation and Embryology Authority ruled that scientists will be allowed to use hybrid human-animal embryos as a source of stem cells for medical research. Well, our special guest this week is Janet Radcliffe Richards, a philosopher at University College London, and hopefully she'll be able to help us unravel some of the key issues here. Janet, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much indeed for inviting me.
We'll come back to you in just a moment, but Ian, take us through first what Craig Venter has been up to.
Well, he became the first to publish in an academic journal his entire genome, and by that I mean for the first time it was diploid. It was the genome inherited from both of his parents and the entire genetic set.
Every base pair.
Yeah, 2.81 billion base pairs.
What does it tell him? We know that people are discovering genes for this and that all the time. What has he found out about himself?
Well, he's had it for a long time, obviously, and it's been up on his website along with that of James Watson for a short while. But, the one thing that he would say he knew about it was that he had a variant for a gene which gave him a moderate risk of Alzheimer's. But he didn't divulge any more. There's more in his book which is coming out, but I think he's holding that back so that we'll buy his book.
What kinds of limitations are there on sequences like this? You can't simply read it and think, right, I'm going to get these diseases. I mean, you have to be fairly knowledgeable about genetics to understand what this stuff means.
Well, one of the big points Craig Venter was talking about when I had a chat with him about this was he said that one of the reasons he wanted to publish this was that he thinks people are getting too hung up on sort of genetic determinism because of how genetics has come into the public consciousness. People think of genetics as being digital, as if you have a gene, you will get cystic fibrosis. If you have a certain gene, you'll get Huntington's disease. And he thinks people have taken this on a bit far, whereas he's saying a lot of these genes are risk factors. And so he may have a certain risk factor for heart disease, we all do. People almost pull the environment out of these things. So he's less worried about the information that's in there, according to him anyway.
It's a good place to move on to the ethics of this. Janet, can you outline for you, what do you see as some of the ethical issues with the way we're moving forward with, you know, sequencing our own genomes and trying to understand from a molecular point of view what we're all made up of?
I don't see the ethical problems. It's other people who see the ethical problems. I think it's not clear why this is different from a whole lot of other things we routinely do. We can't predict what's going to happen as a result of this knowledge, but in just the same way we couldn't predict what would come about as a result of our developing computers or anything else. They all have enormous knock-on effects. And the speed science and technology is going, the unpredictability of these effects is going to get larger and larger.
Do you think that people are more concerned about genetics, for example, than computers because there's something human about, well, of course, there's something human about it. It's about us rather than some inanimate object.
I think it is. And I think it's all to do with fundamental ideas about interfering with nature and messing around with it. And the trouble is, that's an idea about the natural world which doesn't make any sense at all since Darwin. it belongs to a much earlier kind of cosmology where you believed that there was a way that things ought to be and you messed around with them at your peril. There are a great many people still who think that nature is something which can be interfered with and which has been. I mean, this is deep in the ecology, the radical ecology movement, the idea that there's a balance of things which we've interfered with. And I think people have some vague idea that the same thing happens when we mess around with ourselves, which is different from messing around with computers. But things go wrong in evolution. Of course they do. Go wrong in the sense that they produce outcomes that we don't like. Mm. We're particularly worried about being responsible for the mess. If Huntington's comes up or some other nasty gene, it's not our fault. But if we start messing around with it, it is our fault. And this doesn't make the outcome any worse, but it affects the way we think about our input into it.
James, you've got a question?
Aren't there some practical implications to Craig Venter putting his genome out there for his kids? I mean, when you think about life insurance, up until the point where we realised that cigarettes were bad for you, life insurance companies wouldn't ask you whether you smoked, but now they do. That's kind of fair enough because those people who are smoking are taking a risk, and so their life insurance can be weighted because they've taken that risk. Now, it's a little bit unfair if you do that perhaps with people on the basis of their genetics, because there's nothing they can do about that. It's not a choice that they've made. And by Venter doing this, he's made the choice to make that information available. It's available for his kids as well, effectively, and maybe they'll be penalised in the future.
There are serious questions about privacy, and I don't know that there's any simple answer to them. It's just going to be a question of making rules which give an acceptable balance to these things. Now, the question about the insurance is rather different because it depends on what you think insurance is. If you think it's a matter of providing a sort of safety net for people, that's what a decent social society does. But insurance isn't normally that at all. It's a matter of individuals deciding they're going to pool a risk for the benefit of all of them. And they, as individuals, don't want outsiders coming in who are going to skew the probabilities but still only pay in the same stake. And it doesn't matter what the cause is, because the idea of this is not a matter of social justice and compensating for deep unfairnesses. This is just a pragmatic device for a group of people getting together. And it's very interesting the way genes are brought up as something which insurance companies shouldn't know about, because they make all kinds of other inquiries about things that we can't help, like our family history and whether we happen to have bought a house on a floodplain without knowing it was a floodplain. This is just taken for granted, so the question is why it should suddenly be regarded as unfair that genetic information should come in. The moral issue here is a much deeper one about what a decent society should be doing to protect people from risk and how much this should be a matter of individual effort.
Who should be dealing with this stuff in society? Is it something that members of the public should somehow just get over and carry on understanding that the genetics is nothing special and that it's just another bit of knowledge? Or should scientists, philosophers, or government, or who's imposing rules on us? Well, what should happen?
Well, obviously it's the government that's doing the imposing of the rules, but there's not the slightest reason for saying that there should be a moratorium, that we should stop finding out, because if what we're concerned about is the outcome, we're just as likely to have a bad outcome through not knowing as we are through knowing. In fact, we're more likely to, because the more we know, the more we have at least a chance of preventing things from going wrong. And again, I think it's just this fear of doing too much.
I'm Alok Jha, and you're listening to Science Weekly from Guardian Unlimited. Still to come, more on synthetic life forms and the ethics of genetics with Janet Radcliffe-Richards. Plus, we discuss the science of sex, drugs and rock and roll. Well, that's all coming up later, but first, it's time to get up to date with the rest of the science and tech news that's been making headlines over the past 7 days.
News Jack.
British stem cell scientists celebrated the end of a lengthy battle to create embryos which are part human and part animal last week, after the research was approved by the government's fertility watchdog. The decision to allow cytoplasmic hybrid embryos by inserting human DNA into the empty animal egg followed a 3-month public consultation which found participants were broadly in favour of the research.
The London-based architectural firm Foster & Partners has won a competition to design the world's first private spaceport. The site in New Mexico's Mojave Desert will act as mission control and terminal for commercial flights into suborbital space. That's 70 miles above the Earth.
Scientists have uncovered a gene that could be a key factor in whether a person piles on the pounds. Animals without a working copy become obese and suffer related problems such as diabetes. The researchers hope the discovery will point to new ways to tackle obesity.
And finally, Fido, you aren't welcome. Australian scientists have found that the presence of dog walkers leads to a 40% drop in the abundance of wild birds and a 35% reduction in their diversity at natural sites. They say dog walking should be banned from sensitive conservation areas.
James and Nell, thank you both. Janet, there was two stories that were quite interesting in there. One of them was the HFEA, that's the Human Fertilisation and Embryology Authority. They are going to license potentially the use of part human and part animal hybrid embryos to get stem cells for medical research. Then a sort of a second story about another gene discovery. This is a key factor in whether a person sort of is potentially going to be obese or not. The first one, It's been a bit of a problem for scientists for the last 9 months now. The government sort of potentially banning this research and curtailing stuff, which goes straight into what you were saying earlier about being slightly Luddite about new technology. And the second one is about sort of not taking responsibility for your potential flaws. If I'm fat, it's my genes, isn't it? These are two aspects of this sort of moral maze we find ourselves in when it comes to trying to do medical research nowadays. What was your thoughts on the use of hybrid animal and human embryos?
I think it's a bit misleading to call them hybrid human animal embryos, which rather implies as though we're breeding centaurs if we allow these things to carry on much further. There's a very strict limit on the development of an embryo, on time limit for research. So it struck me as an unequivocally good idea, and the question is why people should object to it. I presume a lot of the objections are religious, but then we have the interesting question of why religious objections should be taken notice of in a secular government policy.
Ian, you wrote about the story. What were the objections? I mean, who's doing the objecting?
Well, the objections are obviously, yeah, from the religious groups, but also from pro-life groups, and clearly there's some overlap between those two. The most often heard objection is that you are creating embryos, you're creating them to destroy them, to harvest stem cells, and this is the whole thought which is driving Bush's policy. The other one was blurring the distinction between humanity and animals, which is held by some of the pro-life groups. And there is a huge assumption in here. Maybe it's not for me to comment on, but I think a lot of the cartoons you see on this research seem to go to as if these things end up being live births, whereas they're only allowed to survive for 14 days maximum. It's a ball of cells. Do the objections stand up at that point? Depends how emotive you are about the word embryo.
It's very interesting, though, because the objection about creating life just to destroy it has obviously nothing whatever to do with the human-animal mixture, because it would apply equally. In fact, one might argue that it would apply more strongly to the pure human ones, because these people have no objection to producing animal embryos to experiment on. Mm. You say pro-life, and there's a bit of an overlap, but I think pro-life, which to start with is a misnomer for what's really going on, is almost always religious, isn't it? I mean, you get some people who'd have doubts about abortion, but the extreme pro-life is nearly always religious, isn't it?
But isn't it the difference is the argument that they're making? There's a pro-life type of argument and there's a religious type of argument, and they're slightly different, although they overlap.
Well, yes, but then you need to explain exactly what the objection is. And what the objection is, indeed, to having human-animal crossovers, even if we did develop centaurs and such like, because this is interesting, because Mary Douglas, the anthropologist, put forward the idea, which seems very plausible, that people get very worried about things when they can't classify them properly and they're coming out of the place that we're used to. She thinks this is the origin of food taboos. It's interesting that since Darwin, we shouldn't be so worried about species boundaries. We should just take them as a constantly shifting thing. But if we're concerned about what makes humans special, then we'll be concerned to try and reinforce that boundary. And I suspect that's what's going on. I'm not recommending transitional creatures because it would give us social complexities beyond the intractable ones we're dealing with anyway.
In these cases, even they would survive past a certain embryo stage, would they?
They wouldn't yet, but I'm sure we'll get to a stage when they can.
Just quickly, then, the other story about this potential obesity, skinny gene, as we called it in the newspaper. The last time someone found a gene for obesity, which means if you have the wrong copy of the gene, you're likely to be 1.3 kilograms heavier or something. People were kind of angry about this. It's like, why are we trying to find this stuff out? It just gives people an excuse to be fat. I just want to know what you think about this sort of sense of responsibility that people shift away from themselves once they realise that their genetics are programmed in a certain way.
As you were implying earlier when you were commenting on the genome, it's not a suggestion that the genes are going to make you inevitably fat. It just, from what I understand about this, implies that, I suppose, for a given amount that you eat and for a given amount of environmental input and how much you exercise, you'll be a bit heavier if you're one kind of gene than another. But that doesn't suggest that there's nothing you can do about it. What's it supposed to be an excuse for? That's the interesting thing. I mean, if you don't want to be fat, if it's unpleasant being fat, then you have an incentive to stop it, whether it's genetic or whether it's something to do with how much you eat. It's interesting that it goes back to the idea of people being ultimately responsible for what they are, so you can blame them for everything. That's not what's going on when an individual is worried about being fat. They're worried about how they fit into society, what their health is going to be like. It doesn't really matter whether it's genetic or not.
Okay, Janet, well, thank you for all those. You can add your thoughts to any of these topics and find plenty more to get your teeth into at the Science Blog. That's blogs.guardian.co.uk/science.
Hi, folks, this is Brian May. You're listening to Science Weekly on Guardian Unlimited.
Now, Brian May is one of the exceptions to the rule, but scientists have taken it upon themselves to try and conclusively prove that rock stars really do live fast and die young. From suicides to drug overdoses and murders to bizarre gardening accidents, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is full of those who've come to a sticky end before their time. Now, we'll hear some more thoughts from our very own troubadour physicist and rock star, Johnny Berliner, in just a moment. But first, James, you were reporting on this. Can you give us some examples of rock stars that carked it early? And also, what was the point of the research the scientists were up to?
Well, there are loads of examples. Rock excess has led to the deaths of, Janis Joplin, Jimi Hendrix, Kurt Cobain. But I don't know, it was kind of a classic example of the scientific mind taking on a question that it doesn't seem like rocket science to prove that the lifestyle of Keith Richards, that led him not to be able to remember the 70s is bad for your health, to be honest. But,
but he's not dead, though.
Well,
that's an exception to that particular study.
That's a good point, actually. But essentially what these guys were doing was almost kind of actuarial analysis of the rock industry in the way that you might take on, say, the merchant shipping industry and say, right, how do people die? What sort of accidents befall them? And how can the industry change itself to prevent those from happening? They did the same thing. They looked at 1,000 rock stars who'd made it into a kind of rock hall of fame that had been voted for by lots of people. And then they looked at just over 100 of them. Yeah, that's right. 100 had died. And they looked at how they died and when they died. And they found that the rock stars tended to die earlier than the normal people, if you like. And the most dangerous time for being a rock star is in your first 5 years of fame. The first 5 years in the limelight, you're three times more likely to die than similar people in the population.
I assume that this stuff's going to be used for insurance and that.
Well,
kind of thing,
I don't know. When I spoke to them, they seem to be suggesting that they found things like the use of illicit drugs and alcohol overdoses and things like that were disproportionately involved in rock star deaths.
They found that.
Big surprise.
Shocking.
Yeah, and so they were suggesting that venues could use this information to restrict the amount that rock stars use backstage.
You want to just pat them on the head, don't you? A little bit.
It's just like
sort of pat them on the head.
I can see the thought process that's gone through here, but it's slightly divorced from reality, I think.
But on the other hand, imagine if they'd discovered the opposite conclusion. That would have been worth finding out.
That would have been interesting. That would have been interesting. Yes. I suppose so.
All right. Well, we're not meaning to denigrate the fine work of these scientists, of course. But let me get a case study. Johnny B is Science Weekly's resident troubadour rock star and general sort of genius physicist. What are the occupational hazards of a life spent indulging sex, drugs, and rock and roll? Well, I mean, you look pretty good for it.
Well, thanks. You know, I've been doing it for a few years now. And it takes its toll. you know, the flashbacks.
Is it the yoga that helps you?
The groupies.
The groupies are fun, yeah. But they don't really present a worry to my health, I don't think.
Well,
I suppose there are STDs, but, you know, you can be a careful rock star.
All right, OK, before we get into a discussion about Johnny B's STDs, or lack of, Johnny, why don't you tell us in the way you know best?
Rock and roll is my life, only way to keep me satisfied. Read the news, it makes me cry, it's statistically proven to help me die. Rock and roll's so much fun, that's why I sing it to everyone. It's a shame this job I done is statistically proven to kill me young. Might as well do heavy drugs, smoke 50 fags a day. If scientists are telling me I'm gonna die young anyway, yeah. Rock and roll, my heart's desire, burns inside me like a fire. I'll get famous in Japan and kill myself because I can. But in Otis on a plane, some kill themselves like Kurt Cobain. Janis drank, Jeff Buckley drowned, and now they're 6 foot underground. I might as well do heavy drugs, smoke 50 fags a day. If scientists are telling me gonna die young anyway. Dying every day, I should get some danger pay. Though death's the danger of the game, it's statistically proven to get you fame.
Yay.
We don't want you dead. Right, time for some feedback from the last couple of weeks. Shane G has told us.
Using flipper music as an introduction to a story about the extinction of the Yangtze River dolphin is disgustingly glib.
Well, yes, it was a bit shame, but as we told you last week, the Yangtze may not be quite as extinct as we first thought. Anyway, Martin Coote says.
It was mentioned recently that producer Ben's been looking for a new theme tune for the show. Personally, I love the guitars and don't want them to go.
Well, you're on your own there, Martin. And finally, Nick Jeffries in Sri Lanka has told us.
I used to listen to Sade. And now I listen to Garden Science Podcast.
Is that your mum?
My mum doesn't know how to use Facebook. Anyway, we finally reached our target and smashed the 500 barrier with our Facebook group. Applause, everyone. That was terrible. We promised you something special and we weren't lying, really, but we were. First prize is the opportunity to come in and join us here in the pod and contribute to the show. Second prize is 2 weeks in our delightful company. Who will win? Producer Ben, I believe you've got a list of names in the top hat. People, we can guarantee this is absolute probity here. Johnny B, do you want to do the honours? An entirely randomly selected winner.
It's Hazel Morris.
Well done, Hazel. Producer Ben will be in touch. Hopefully you live in London, otherwise our budget doesn't stretch to you coming here. But now then, back to business. Our special guest this week is Janet Radcliffe-Richards. And we've got another thing we want to bring up. James wrote a story this week about synthetic life forms. James, we've talked about this subject before in the podcast, which is this idea of creating life forms from scratch. There's been some more news this week. Do you want to just take us through what's happened?
Imagine building life from scratch, you know, taking non-living chemicals, putting them together into something that's alive. Well, scientists have taken a very small but important step towards that this week. But let me just take you back to what we talked about before. Craig Venter is, as you might imagine, involved. He's got his greasy paws into this field as well. And we've talked about him patenting a set of genes that are the minimal ones needed to run a bacterium, basically. So his approach is you take something very simple already, strip it down to something even more simple. Well, what these guys are trying to do is much harder, really. They're trying to start from non-living things and build up an organism from scratch. And what they've built is a very simple cell, really, with a cell membrane made out of lipids, 36 enzymes, a ribosome, which is basically a molecular component of a cell that makes protein and one gene. And when you put all that together, it does protein synthesis from the gene. It makes a green fluorescent protein, which is what that gene encodes. And the reason this is significant is that once you can do protein synthesis, you can make all the other useful bits of cells, and you know, you're on the way to being able to make something that's alive. But this thing at the moment obviously is pretty simple and is not actually alive.
Surely it's not just about making something that's alive. I mean, what are these things going to be doing, hopefully, one day?
Well, the reason Vent is interested in this field is that he can, you know, once you've got something very simple, you know exactly how it works, you know all the bits of it that are important, you can start bolting onto it things that are useful. So you can make hydrogen, you can make something that eats up pollution, that kind of thing. These guys, Italian researchers led by Giovanni Mertas, are they're more interested in understanding evolution. But the general advantage of synthetic biology, the whole field, is that by tinkering around with the building blocks, you can be really sure that you understand what's going on. You know, if you can take things away, add them, and know what's going on, then, you know, you really understand the system.
Janet, let me play devil's advocate now. We're just racing ahead with this stuff, aren't we? And we could potentially create something that's going to eat the world or whatever. Who knows?
Yes, we could, and we probably will. In fact, one of the interesting ethics issues about this is that however much we agonise over it, we're not going to stop it. It's going ahead.
Someone somewhere will do it.
We're that kind of species, and we will just push on with this. I really can't work this out. It goes in a way back to entropy. There are far more ways of things going wrong than going right.
The universe is conspiring against us, is what you're saying.
Well, it doesn't have to. That's the whole point. We have to conspire to stop it going wrong. But when you think about all the little things like introducing alien species into somewhere like Australia and noticing the havoc it creates because we didn't... however much you know about the internal structure of these organisms, you cannot foresee the long-term consequences. But I don't know any way around that. And it doesn't look like a good reason for doing nothing.
And there's no reason to stop?
I can't see why it should be.
I'm a bit more sanguine about the whole kind of grey goo problem of these things getting out, and you know, the analogy with Australia going out and causing havoc somewhere, because even when they get further than they've got now, they're going to be so rubbish that they're not going to get anywhere. As soon as they get out of the lab, they're going to get eaten by something.
They'll start evolving.
Jana, I just wanted to tap into another one of your expertises actually, and ask you a little bit of a side issue about the psychology of the people doing some of this research. When Craig Venter published his genome, he mentioned, oh, you know, James Watson's will be coming out soon. And I said, oh, you know, jokingly, were you in a race? And he said, no, but if we were, I would have done it 3 years earlier. Mm-hmm. We know that there's a guy running another gene sequencing company who's going to come out with his own genome. Is this a macho field? Is this something that's usefully driving research? I'm just interested if there's a psychology question here.
I'm sure there is. I don't know whether it's useful, but I think it's inevitable. I think it's inevitable partly because of human psychology, and if males aren't competing about that, they'll be competing about something else, and it's not quite clear which are the least harmful things for them to compete about. You know, they could compete as being expert Morris dancers. That would be quite safe. But anything else
and very useful somehow.
is it a male thing?
I think there's a tendency for it to be more male than female for very good evolutionary reasons. Obviously, nothing like a complete divide between the two, but I'm sure it is.
What are those reasons?
Darwin realised that as soon as you got creatures sophisticated enough to have emotions and the like, what those emotions were would have as much effect on their survival as anything else about them. So the question is, would you expect the same kind of characteristics to be successful from a breeding point of view in males and females? And just from the straight physiology of males and females, you would expect a difference, because a female producing flat out can only produce about one child a year. A male, if he manages to keep other males off and be attractive enough to females, can have almost indefinitely many children. And so you would, therefore, evolutionarily, some men are likely to be winners in having far more than, as it were, their fair share of offspring, and the others are going to be outright losers and leave nothing. So you would expect this to produce a different kind of character in males and females. Now, we didn't go into the detail of that, but you would expect that in some way the males are going to have to compete. And if it isn't actually knocking each other's heads off, it's at least going to be doing something which will impress the females.
Like sequencing their genes.
So the competitiveness seems very likely to be built in. One of the interesting things about this evolutionary psychology stuff, which is still in its infancy and we're only just exploring it, is that if we find that something which history has shown to be really entrenched and we wondered whether it was cultural, if we see the evidence coming from a different direction as well, that strengthens the reason for thinking it's rather deeper than just culture.
Okay, well, we'll wind up there, but we'll give you the last word, Janet, on something that obviously the Ben Goldacre wrote, which you wanted to take on a little bit. This was, James, remind us a bit about what Ben was talking about in his column last week.
Yeah, this was Ben taking apart a piece of science about why women prefer pink colours over blue and the differences between colour perception between men and women. And, well, quite apart from Ben, there was also one of our columnists, Zoe Williams, who kind of read this very much in terms of a kind of feminist narrative, if you like, and that we shouldn't be doing this kind of research. We shouldn't be throwing up differences between men and women because it just encourages people to be sexist.
I think Ben was dead right in saying that particular research wasn't very good. In fact, the argument was nonsense. Nothing to do with evolutionary psychology. You'd have to explain how it was that, what did he say? What was it? Picking out red berries when you were gathering somehow affected the number of offspring you had as opposed to the number that the men had. It didn't make any sense at all. The question of feminism, it strikes me as, let's see, the original arguments for keeping women in their proper place were that men and women were different. This is what the Victorians were saying. There was a sort of backlash to this, saying, we don't want to be treated like this. We're not different. It's just the way you've treated us. And that idea has somehow stuck. But you don't actually need the claim that men and women are different by nature to say that women were very badly treated originally and still are. And a lot needs doing about it. And it seems to me catastrophic for women if you're going to have to take as a starting point of feminism that there are no natural differences between the sexes, since, I would say, it is manifestly false.
Well, that's all we can squeeze into this half hour of Portable Pod Size Brilliance. If you want to comment on anything we've discussed in the show, and it's been quite a lot of it, head back to Facebook or the science blog at blogs.guardian.co.uk/science. Thanks to everyone in the pod, Ian Sample, James Randerson, Nell Bowes, and the incomparable Johnny Billiner, and our special guest, of course, Janet Radcliffe-Richards. Science Weekly has been produced by Ben Green. I've been Alok Jha. See you next time.
Guardian Unlimited.